Good afternoon. I'm David Haynes, the opinions editor at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Welcome to the St. Patrick's Day edition of the Journal Sentinel's On Politics. I'm going to be joined in studio today by Daniel Bice, a columnist for the paper, and from Washington by Craig Gilbert, and also from Madison by Patrick Marley, one of our reporters in Madison. So here's what's on tap today. The political circus is coming to town. The race for the state Supreme Court heats up. We'll have an interview with Daniel Bice interviewing Mayor Tom Barrett, and we'll take your questions. But first, let's turn to Craig Gilbert in Washington. So let's turn first to Craig Gilbert, the Journal Sentinel's Washington bureau chief. And Craig, it looks like the circus, the political circus at least, is about to come to town. What can we expect in Wisconsin?
So on the Democratic side, you know, it seems like Hillary Clinton does have an insurmountable lead in delegates. But Bernie Sanders' campaign signaled very strongly yesterday that they're going to soldier on, and also that they see Wisconsin as one of a number of upcoming states that are good for them. And there's some truth to that. It's favorable turf demographically. If you look at how different groups of voters have voted and if you look at Wisconsin's own political history, it's been a tough state for Hillary Clinton. It was in 2008. So they, in a conference call with reporters yesterday, they twice referred to the big showdown in Wisconsin. So they're definitely going to play in Wisconsin. What we don't know is how hard Hillary Clinton's going to play in Wisconsin. On the Republican side, it is definitely, it's a really, really interesting state because demographically it looks pretty good for Donald Trump with a big kind of white, blue-collar vote in Wisconsin. But he hasn't been polling well here. So in that sense, there's an opportunity for Ted Cruz and John Kasich and all the sort of stop Trump people to try to, you know, rack up a defeat of Donald Trump while he's the front runner and while he's trying to get to a majority of delegates. So
right. And he was leading in the last market poll, as I recall, but Rubio had something like 20% of the voters at that point. Where do you think the Rubio voters might go? Has anyone sussed that out yet?
That we don't know. I mean, they've only got two choices if they don't like Donald Trump at this point. And I think, you know, in terms of elected officials, Rubio had actually gotten more endorsements from elected Republicans than anybody. I think, you know, a few of them will go to Kasich. I think more of them will go to Cruz, if that matters. But I just think that even though Donald Trump has been leading in the last two polls in Wisconsin, the field was very fragmented. And his image wasn't that positive among Republican voters here. So he's unquestionably been polling worse in Wisconsin than most other states.
Mm-hmm. Now, you're working on a piece for our Sunday newspaper that talks about some really interesting data that you've seen in the polling about Trump's support. Why don't you talk a bit about that?
So if you look over the last 5 or 6 months of polling by Marquette, you know, Donald Trump's numbers haven't really changed very much. But what's interesting are these massive regional differences among Republican voters within Wisconsin. I mean, he's really kind of unpopular in the parts of Wisconsin that we think of as being like the Republican bedrock of the state, particularly the, you know, places like Waukesha, Washington, and Ozaukee County, southeastern Wisconsin suburbs and exurbs, which have been kind of the kingmakers in Republican politics in Wisconsin. That's where he's getting his worst numbers. The other extreme is northern and western Wisconsin, the more rural part of the state, where he doesn't have fantastic numbers, but he has much more positive numbers than he does in southeastern Wisconsin. So there is kind of a north-south thing going on with Donald Trump in Wisconsin that picks up on some patterns we've seen in other states where Donald Trump tends to do better with voters who are lower levels of education, less income, in some cases more rural. And it's just that the pattern is so stark in Wisconsin, it's really interesting.
Yeah. Is there any way to tell how much of the lack of support from the Wild counties, Waukesha, Ozaukee, and Waukesha, and Washington, is because ideologically they don't see Trump as somebody they could support, or has it got something to do about his temperament and demeanor?
So I think statewide, I think he's been held back a little bit by temperament and demeanor. I think that's one explanation for why he hasn't been polling as well in Wisconsin. In southeastern Wisconsin, there could be a bunch of things going on. I mean, I talked about the demographics of higher levels of income and education. You've got the fact that Donald Trump is not winning the most conservative voters, and it's a very conservative area. It's also kind of an area where people, it's a more establishment area when it comes to party politics. You know, Mitt Romney did well here. John McCain did well here in their primaries. Rick Santorum and Mike Huckabee did not do well in southeastern Wisconsin. talk radio could be a factor because you've got the conservative media in southeastern Wisconsin has been pretty anti-Trump and much more so than I think nationally. Right. And so I think a lot of things are going into this.
Yeah. So let's shift gears. President Obama nominated Merrick Garland to be to replace Antonin Scalia on the U.S. Supreme Court. What do you think is going to happen with that? Any chance that the Republican senators who have stood lockstep against even considering a nomination might change their minds? And where's Ron Johnson on this?
Republican senators have really dug in. I think there are some individual senators that Democrats are hoping to pick off who are up for re-election. Ron Johnson, of course, is up for re-election. He's one of the vulnerable Republican incumbents, but he's been sort of digging in on this as well. You know, one question is whether he'll meet with the nominee. Another question is whether he would, you know, before we even get to the question of whether they'd vote for the nominee, is the question of whether they'd meet with the nominee and whether they'd support having hearings for the nominee. So it'll be interesting to watch Ron Johnson. But I think right now the Republicans, after a little bit of back and forth, have kind of dug in on this because I think they fear a backlash from their own base if they show any wiggle room. And that's where the lines are drawn right now.
So, Craig, quickly, we're almost out of time, but is there any evidence that that issue, the Supreme Court nomination, is playing at all in politics here in Wisconsin?
We just don't know. I mean, we do know from the polling, from some polling that has been done, that, you know, most voters say the Senate should hold hearings. But we don't know whether that's an issue that will affect the way people vote.
Great. Craig Gilbert, our Washington Bureau Chief, thanks so much. All right, welcome back. We're going to go now to Patrick Marley, who's in Madison, one of our reporters there. Patrick, welcome.
Hi, Dad.
Hello to you, and happy St. Patrick's Day. So you have no green on, just like me.
Well, I forgot. My daughter remembered, though.
So the Supreme Court race in Wisconsin heated up this week with another very pointed debate at the Marquette Law School. There's another debate, yet another one, on Friday night. Where do you think this race is headed? What can we look for in the coming days?
I think things are really going to ramp up for the April 5 election. You know, this is Bradley and Kloppenburg were very close in the February primary. Bradley won by, it was ahead by, you know, 2 points, 1.5 points, somewhere in there. And the supporters of Kloppenburg see this as a race that they could potentially win. We're going to have much higher turnout than we normally do for a Supreme Court race because it's the same day as the presidential primary. Third party group is on the air with an ad against Kloppenburg. Both candidates are now on the air. So I think that everything just sort of gets, you know, on steroids here in the next few weeks.
So to what extent does that presidential race play into this race?
Oh, it's a huge factor because it will bring in so many more voters than usually come to the polls. So that's, you know, I think it's been 2000 was the last time we had a presidential primary and a Supreme Court race on the same day. So you're just going to see a lot more people, you know, perhaps numbers similar to what we saw in 2011 when Kloppenburg made her first run and lost to David Prosser.
Yeah, and that's a good segue to my next question. At that time, my impression was that Kloppenburg essentially was running against Scott Walker as much as she was running against David Prosser. It was in the wake of the Act 10, which was very unpopular at that time with liberals in particular. And this time, in a sense, I sense she's trying to do that again in running against Walker, who appointed Rebecca Bradley three times. How do you think that's playing? And does that make sense given where Walker's at politically?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a fair comparison. You know, the 2011 race was a very sleepy affair. Almost nobody was paying any attention to it. David Prosser, who's been on the court since the 1990s, didn't seem to have any problem. Then Act 10 happened, these huge protests. This recall effort was getting underway. Mm-hmm. Grassroots people were activated on both sides. And that race became a referendum on Scott Walker and Act 10, even though the candidates weren't stating their position on Act 10, and it wasn't until months afterward that the court started ruling on that policy. This time, central to Kloppenburg's campaign is that Rebecca Bradley has been gotten court appointments from Scott Walker three times in 3 years. So it's very much an anti-Walker message as part of what Kloppenburg's running on. And it comes at a time when Walker's numbers have been in the high 30s, maybe 40% since he dropped out of the presidential race last fall.
Right. So I mentioned the pointed debate the other night at Marquette. And one of the issues there are the writings that Rebecca Bradley did as a college student which she has since said that she's apologized for multiple times. But Kloppenburg isn't really accepting that apology and is framing it as a judgment issue. How do you think that's playing with voters? Can you tell at this point?
I mean, we don't see a lot of polling, so it's hard to tell. I mean, I think that was a bad run of stories for Rebecca Bradley because mm-hmm. it did highlight some things that she'd written in college. She's apologizing for the comment she made about gays and is pointing out that she was 21 at the time. That was 24 years ago. Kloppenburg clearly sees that that's a storyline that helps her and is not letting that go. It's interesting in that Rebecca Bradley has greatly distanced herself from her comments about AIDS patients and gays, mm-hmm. but there are other things she wrote, for instance, about abortion, where she just won't comment on what she wrote back as a college student, where she compared it to murder and the Holocaust. Because that's an issue that might come before the court, she won't say what her current views are.
And possibly that could play well with base voters. It's hard to tell. Patrick, thanks for that. Stand by. We're going to move now to an interview that Daniel Bice did with Mayor Tom Barrett, and he talks about what he's done during his years in office and what he's looking to do in the years ahead.
Well, let's jump into it. So poverty remains high in Milwaukee. Unemployment continues to be a problem for African-American males. Milwaukee's school system is deeply troubled, and crime is on a lot of people's minds. Why should we give you another 4 years in office with that sort of record?
Well, I'd love to talk about every one of those things. And I want to start talking about the jobs in the city right now. If you look at our employment numbers right now, at the end of 2015, there were more Milwaukee residents who had jobs than at the end of any year since 2001. Okay. More Milwaukee residents had jobs. So that's the good news. The bad news is, as you alluded to in your question, there's more poverty. So how can this be? More people have jobs, more poverty. In my mind, there's several things. One, there's clearly a wage issue. And there's only so much local government can do about the wage issue. I'd like to see the state raise the minimum wage. I'd like to see them make the earned income tax credit more robust so that individuals who are working can then support their families. But the other issue is health care that goes along with that. And that is a place where I would ask the residents of the city to give me another 4 years because we really have aggressively tried to make sure that people have health care. And we were just recognized by the White House, winning a competition among 20 cities. Right. And so we have more residents working, a lot of people with health care, but the wage issue remains real.
You're not saying that unemployment's not a problem, particularly for African-American males in the city.
No, I'm not. I'm not. But even there, we've made some progress. And okay. It's not something that I can brag about. But what I will say is Dr. Mark Levine from UWM, who does the analysis right. of joblessness, which is not to be confused with the unemployment rate. It's actually a higher number. We have seen a 10% reduction in the joblessness number for African-American men between 2010 and 2014. It's still at 37%, but he had the figure at 47% in 2010. I asked him where he thought the progress was coming from, and he said all the construction that's going on is probably contributing to this. And that's something where we've put a focus in trying to make sure that city residents have some of those jobs.
There are stories about increase in violent crime, problem with carjackings, car thefts.
And I'd like to talk about those. Our Milwaukee police, between 2011 and 2016, essentially, have increased the arrests, juvenile arrests for car thefts, operating a vehicle without owner's consent, by 300%. A 300% increase of arrests from our police. So I am not in any way going to criticize the Milwaukee Police Department because they're doing their job. But I think anybody who looks at this recognizes that the police, that's the purview of the city. The juvenile justice system includes much more than that. It includes the district attorney, it includes the judges, it includes probation, parole, the county. And what I've done very aggressively is tried to bring all the different components of the juvenile justice system together because I think there is a problem. I think there is a problem when you've got a juvenile who has stolen a car three times or more. There has to be consequences for that individual. I understand the first time you can say it's a joyride. Second time, as long as there's a gun, you can even make the same argument. But once you reach a young person who has now stolen a car three times, there has to be consequences.
This is your three strikes, you're out?
No, policy. I wouldn't say three strikes and you're out. That's not my policy. But I just think as a parent,
so what do you have to have. So what do you do? You're going to push legislation on this?
Well, no. Again, what I've tried to do, and I'm doing it right now in real time. This is not something where it's pie in the sky. What I've said is, and we've worked with the district attorney very well. John Chisholm has been incredibly cooperative on this. We've worked so that we can now have, and Mike Murphy's been helpful here too, to put some crime analysts in the district attorney's office, two crime analysts,
right,
so we can do a longitudinal analysis to see what happens to the kids who are arrested. So where is there a problem? Because we have seen a dramatic increase in the number of car thefts and carjackings, and that's very real. I don't minimize that for a second. But it's not as though we're just wringing our hands. We're trying to, in real time, get down to the root of the problem so there can be consequences. Now, where it gets more complicated is, I'm not even saying send them to Lincoln Hills. Lincoln Hills has got tons of problems, as your paper has recorded. Part of the concern I have when we talk about bringing kids from Lincoln Hills back locally, if they're going to go into local detention beds, are they going to take spots where a kid should have gotten something quick? What I mean by something quick, third time, you've got to have something. You've got to have consequences when a kid does this the third time. If those beds are gone because we're filling with Lincoln Hills kids, then we've got an issue. So that's why I said I'm concerned about the placement of kids back in the community based on capacity of our system.
The ads you're running now are attack ads on Bob
those
Donovan.
Are beautiful ads. They're nice ads, man. Come on.
I love negative ads. So, yes, they're great for me. But the focus is very much on your opponent. First of all, why did you decide to go negative here in the general election? And then, two, shouldn't this be a referendum on you? You're the one who's been in office for 12 years.
I think there's a couple things here. One, obviously, I've been in office for 12 years, and I've said repeatedly I'm not going to make my opponent's length of service in City Hall an issue, even though he's served 4 years longer than I have.
Right.
So if people want to talk about length of service, then we can talk about length of service. But seriously, what happened was we had an outside group. I have no idea who they are, who is spending dollars. My sense is it's money from outside the state. And as you know, I'm the world's nicest guy.
You think
guy.
It's outside the state. That's who do you think it is?
I don't know who it is. I literally don't know who it is. But my rule of thumb, and I have this, you always can sort of judge someone's future behavior by their last past behavior. I've lost this same tooth in a fight twice, 40 years apart.
Okay.
My rule of thumb is, if you hit me in the nose, there's a pretty good chance I'm going to hit you right back. And so our ad started running, maybe 24 hours after that ad started running.
The streetcar. We haven't talked about the streetcar.
Sure. Obviously something that was offensive.
Yeah,
when I say on the offensive.
It was offensive to some people, too.
Exactly.
There was a recent poll that showed that less than 50% of the people in Milwaukee support the streetcar. One of our viewers asked the question, why don't you put this out to referendum instead of just deciding this on your own?
We've had the Common Council consider it twice.
Right.
We have a representative democracy. We could put all sorts of things on the ballot for people to do it if we're going to go to a pure democracy. That's not the system we have. But let me explain what my rationale is here. And again, I realize that it's controversial. To me, this is all about economic development. And if you just look at what has happened already on economic development, you have the old post office building that's right on the line sell for $2 to $3 million more than the asking price. The Grand Avenue Mall, which is just off the line but close to where the line could be, that went for $7 million more this year than it did last year. You've got the new lot that's located just south of U.S. Bank. We're very optimistic that we're going to have employment there. That is tied to the streetcar as well. So for me, it's about jobs. And I understand where there's people opposed to it, but when I've talked to people in Portland, for example, what they said to me was, this is going to be very controversial to get it in the ground. Just get it started, then the debate will change as to how do we get it to our neighborhoods. But it's about economic development.
That's not the debate in Atlanta, though.
I haven't been to Atlanta, so I don't know what the debate is in Atlanta.
Well, New York Times and other places have written stories saying that there are lots of problems with the streetcar there since they started. You've not followed what's happening there?
Well, I know that they have one there, but I know, and I'll just use what we've talked about here I'll use the utility issue as an example. The original utility estimates, I think, were $50 to $75 million. We said we disagree with that. We obviously had a fight that we lost with the legislature as to who should incur those costs. But at the same time, we've worked closely with We Energies and the other utilities. The We Energies portion is now $15 million, not $50 million. So we're working with people to reduce those costs.
So is there a maximum amount you would say should be spent on the streetcar for construction of it?
Here's where I think if you want to be critical of me for being defensive, this is a spot where you can be critical. Seriously. Because what I said was, we have this amount of money. We're going to build a line this long, and we're going to, as we get additional dollars, right, that's when we'll extend it. So I wasn't going to go in and have a $600 million project because I didn't think that was fiscally responsible.
Right.
I said, we've got the $54 million from the feds. Now we have an additional $14 million. We've got $68 million from the feds, which, again, cannot be used for something else, which is part of the debate, plus the TIF dollars, which brings us to roughly $125 million. Do I want to extend this? Absolutely yes. But I want to do so in a fiscally responsible fashion.
So what do you see as the maximum? I mean,
I don't have it in my mind. I honestly don't. I'm not being coy.
So this thing might have no ceiling in terms of
how much
it'll
cost. Well,
again,
I think it's going to depend on how successful it is. I realize that of course it should depend on how successful it is. But I'll give you some natural routes, if you will. There's a natural route that goes up 4th Street past the arena into Bronzeville. There's a natural route that goes to UWM. There's a natural route that comes south through the 3rd Ward and the 5th Ward.
Could you see this being a billion-dollar streetcar?
I don't know. I honestly don't know. And if it were to be, it would be done incrementally and paid for as we go along. I am not going to incur debt like that, just to make it clear. Mm-hmm. And I think, again, for people who want to be critical of me for being cautious, I view it as being fiscally responsible and prudent.
Well, welcome back. I'm here now with Dan Bice, columnist for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, who just conducted that interview with Mayor Barrett. Interesting interview, Dan. But I'd like to move to Alderman Bob Donovan's record and his position on the issues at this point. I should point out at this point that, Dan, you've invited Alderman Donovan to do a similar interview. So far, he's declined. He actually was invited to an editorial board meeting earlier this week and walked out of that meeting before sitting down with us. So we'll keep trying. But let's talk about Alderman Donovan on the issues.
You know, even though he declined to talk to me and walked out of that meeting, Mary Spicuzza, Mary's covering that race, and I wanted to see if we could get in touch with him. And so last night we went to a meeting that he had announcing Sheriff Clark's endorsement for him. And interestingly, afterwards, we sat down and talked to him for 10 or 12 minutes about a variety of issues. It was very civil and a very different demeanor than what we saw when he walked out of the editorial board. We covered a lot of topics.
Yeah, what'd you learn?
There were several things. One, I had no idea that he was in favor of residency. He said he was.
I didn't either.
We also asked that he's talked a lot about adding 300 cops to the police force, but he's not explained how he's going to do it. And he didn't give us a very good answer on that as well. He just talked about, he said no tax increase to pay for it, and it would all be done through eliminating duplication and fat within the city.
Yeah, he's talked about the gang and vice squad coming back and all that.
You know, he's got a lot of ideas about things he wants to add, for instance, an education staff member and some other staff members, but he's not laid out a plan for how he's going to pay for any of this stuff. I did ask him why he's so far behind on fundraising, because he was complaining that Bear is beating him up in attack ads, and the mayor knows that he has no way to respond. And his only answer was that the mayor got a head start on him. But, you know, Bob's been running for a long time, and people running for mayor can raise hundreds of thousands of dollars, but he's not been able to do that.
So the polling is showing that the mayor might be gaining a bit, though, right?
I'm familiar with a couple of polls that have been done since the primary, and both suggest that the mayor's gained ground. He won by 13 percentage points, but he was under 50%. And so the polling's suggesting that he's up closer to 20% right now. So, one of the ads attacks Bob Donovan says that he's a Republican. He's always been a Republican. And he bristled at that last night and said, I am not a Republican. So I said, who are you going to vote for in the primary? And he said he hasn't thought about that at all. And I said, so are you going to vote in the Democratic or Republican primary? He said, I haven't thought that about that at all. So I said, so who did you vote for president in 2012? He thought about that for a long time and said, that's between him and God.
Did you check with God, Dan?
He's been unavailable for comment.
Okay. So on a couple of specific issues, we know where he stands on policing and what he'd like to do. We don't know how he'd pay for it. Residency, that's something I didn't know about. Streetcar, he's been very much opposed to that idea. Why? He calls it a billion-dollar streetcar, which I think might be a little more than it's going to cost. But
now, actually, in the interview I did with Mayor Bear, I asked him if there was a cap on how much he was willing to spend on the streetcar, because he says he wants to phase it in over time. And I said, could this be a billion-dollar streetcar? And his answer was yes. It could be because he wants to bring it in, and if the funding is there, he's going to continue to expand, make it bigger and bigger. And you know, for someone like Bob Donovan, a conservative running for office, is an easy issue to oppose because first, mass transit is not very popular with some conservatives, and then two, I think it makes people nervous when you have this project that's going to expand and expand, and you don't know how large it's going to be. I was surprised that the mayor wouldn't put a limit on how much he wants to spend on the streetcar.
Mm-hmm. That's actually surprising to me, too, to hear him say that it could cost $1 billion. That's a lot. One more question, and it relates to sort of Donovan's electability. If you're him now, what do you do to try to get back some of that lost ground that the polling apparently is showing that he's lost?
You know, it's difficult because the only support he has right now is from this third-party group that is running a couple of radio ads for him. He doesn't have much money himself. What he has to do, I think, to get back in the game is get as much free media as possible, and that would include talking to us and other outlets. But obviously when we gave him a chance to sit here and talk for 25 minutes and post what he had to say, he said no. When we offered him the edit board, he said no. So right now I don't see his strategy for coming back and closing the gap with Mayor Bear. But, of course, anything can change. We have a couple more weeks to go.
Yeah, the edit board thing really stunned me. I haven't seen that happen before. We had a situation with Sheriff Clark a few years ago where he threatened to walk out.
I was there, and he said he wouldn't take any questions from me. But, you know, the edit board editor at the time, your predecessor, Ricardo Pimentel, said, we invited you. If you want to leave, fine. And the sheriff thought about it and said, I'll stay.
And he stayed. And I should point out that our edit boards are always open to news side reporters. That's just a longstanding policy. Alderman Donovan knows that. He's been in before. He's had reporters in the room.
And I go to a lot of these.
And you go to a lot of them. So that should be no surprise. Well, it's a segue to our questions. We have a couple of questions from readers. They're both related to the Bob Donovan Bob Donovan's campaign. The first is, do you think that Alderman Donovan was planning his dramatic walkout prior to seeing you in the meeting, Dan?
I do not, because if you were to do that first, you're passing up the opportunity to generate some news and positive coverage from that. And then two, I think it just directed people who read about this and had no idea what story it was that I wrote that he took exception to, they were going to go back and look for that story. And it was the story that I wrote had to do with the fact that he's running as a law and order candidate, but he and his campaign manager have had some run-ins with the law.
Correct.
I laid those out
going
in the story.
A number of years, actually. And
I had a number of people call me and asking for links to that story so they could read that themselves. Mm-hmm. So it directed them back to a story that he probably doesn't want them reading.
Mm-hmm. So one final question. We're running short on time here, but this is from, I think we can presume, a supporter of Alderman Donovan, who asks, do you really blame him, Dan, for after he wrote such an insulting and degrading article?
So that's referring to the story I talked about. No, but it's not a meeting with me. There's a dozen people in the room asking a bunch of questions. During that session, I probably would ask two or three questions at most. Editorial board meetings are not
They're not a lot of fireworks generally with those things. So right.
Unless Herman Cain comes to visit. Then,
but he created his own fireworks.
Correct.
And so the question there was, what would you do in Libya? It wasn't a complicated question.
Right.
And
with
Bob, I saw some of your questions that you were preparing to ask, and many of them were not, they were policy related questions.
Right.
They would allow him
Which
to say
what
what he would do if he became mayor. He would get to lay out his plan. It was being videotaped. You would post those things. So do I blame him? He can do whatever he wants to on something like that, but I think for him it was a missed opportunity.
Yeah. Okay. Dan, thanks for being with us. Dan Bice from our Newsite staff. We're also joined today by Craig Gilbert of our Washington Bureau and by Patrick Marley of our Madison Bureau. I'm David Haynes, the opinions editor at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Welcome, and thanks for being with us at this edition of On Politics.